Chodesh Tov, Chanukah Sameach. Got to keep track of the time, because we're running a little bit late here. Because you all know what it means when a rabbi takes off his watch to check the time. It means absolutely nothing. See, some of you have experience with this. I'm going to be addressing some things that Rabbi Cardoza said a few months ago. Some of you might have been there at our annual Teshuvah lecture, wherein Rabbi Cardozo made a very important statement, and it's worth repeating and looking into further. As a result, I devoted some serious time, to looking into this issue, specifically using the paradigm of the Eino Metzuveh Ve'oseh, someone who's not commanded and still follows obligations, follows religious doctrines that he believed to be stemming from God, as a paradigm by which we can understand Judaism better in modern times. I'll explain what I mean. I think many of us feel that there's a growing rift between contemporary Western society, society that forms our background, society that creates much of what we believe in, whether we realize it or not, even if we are Orthodox Jews, that there exists a tremendous gap between this set of values that we have and our values that come from traditional Judaism. We know, and I've discussed with our students, that personal autonomy is one of the central facets, one of the central values of today's society. And perhaps on a trite level, this was expressed by one writer, don't recall his name right now, who put something out after the disaster of 9/11. I think he was a survivor who worked in one of the buildings. And he spoke about what the tragedy meant to him, the value that he thought America stood for. And he summarized it at the time. I sort of poked fun at it. He said that America, to him, stands for the right to eat what we want, when we want, and where we want. And although that sounds very trite, and at the time I said it's a shame to have to die for the right to eat at McDonald's, nonetheless, in the view of many Americans, this is in fact what Western democracy is all about. On a simple, everyday level, and this is certainly something that is rooted in the fundamental philosophy of modern Western civilization. And the fact that Judaism, classical Judaism, says to its members, whether they choose it or not, that they are in fact not subject to this personal autonomy, is a sense of tremendous conflict, both for those within the halachic sphere, as well as for those Jews who do not view themselves as subject to the halacha. What I want to do today is to analyze whether in fact, not touching on the issue of halacha, but to analyze in fact the classical sources of Judaism, and see whether that statement that we assume that Jews are in fact commanded, that we are obligated by the mitzvot, is completely correct. And if it is correct, what is, if any, its significance for the modern Jew? As I said, my point of departure is the talk that Rabbi Cardoza gave a few months ago, wherein, in fact, if you'll see in your prospectus that you have on the chairs, the message from the Dean, Rabbi Cardoza's message, touches upon a topic that he's talked about for many years, the issue of the Judaism of Avram Avinu. And specifically a few months ago, what Rabbi Cardoza did was to suggest that we use Avraham Avinu's Judaism as a paradigm with which to approach non-halachic Jews, to approach Jews that are not religious, or if we want to be optimistic, not yet religious. And one could ask, in terms of understanding Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak Avinu, and their children, were they in fact Jews the same way we are Jews? And classically, most understand that they were not. To put that in more concrete terms, I often ask the question, would we be able to count Avraham as the 10th man in a minyan? If you think the answer is so clear, you should think twice. Classically, pre-Sinaitic Jewry, Jews that lived before Kabbalat Torah, are viewed, even when they kept the commandments, as eno metzuve ve'oseh, someone who does commandments on an optional level. One who's not obligated by God to do mitzvot and still chooses to do so. Rabbi Cardozo developed a very elegant structure in which he explained that when we are interacting with non-Orthodox Jews, we should really present this as their model. Not to tell them or to try to convince them to keep halacha, but rather to understand it and to admire it. And to do it as they see fit, in the same way as Avraham Avinu did it, kept halacha when he saw fit. And there's certain elegance to this model in the sense that Judaism developed in the same way, as Rabbi Cardoza told us, that Jews were not obligated legally before they came to understand and appreciate the divine will. And that one can only come to a state of obligation, to a state of legal obligation, when one first is impressed by what the will, by what the idea is all about. For example, one does not have to keep Lamed Tet Melachot, one does not have to keep all the prohibitions of Shabbat to understand its beauty. In the words of Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous French historian who wrote about the emerging American society, he wrote about the Christian Sabbath that was widely observed, that had certain resemblance to our own Shabbat, less the technical legal requirements. He wrote about it that the Shabbat is a day where the solemn calm of meditation succeeds the turmoil of the week, and the soul resumes possession and contemplation of itself. One can admire the beauty of such a day without keeping its malachot. And thereby, once one has an appreciation of the day, one can better appreciate why it is that one should keep strictures and legal issues related to that day. However, there are certain problems that do exist with the suggestion. Number one, it's difficult to see that from a legal perspective, from the point of view of halacha, that we would be correct in presenting such a paradigm to non-religious Jews. From a religious perspective, they are commanded just as much as the religious Jew. The furthest one could go is the position, the famous position of the Chazon Ish, that they're not, because of their background, they're not liable for punishment for not keeping commandments, but neither are they free. Neither can one say that they're not commanded. The other problem is that it creates a separate box for non-religious Jews. That on the one hand, we are living, again in Rabbi Cardozo's terms, in the Beit Midrash of Moshe Rabbeinu, we are halachic Jews, and they, we allow them to be non-halachic Jews. This creates a two-tiered approach, which I think encourages us Orthodox to maintain what unfortunately is often a condescending and paternalistic view of the non-religious Jew. Now, right, Cardozo is not the only one who suggested looking at the paradigm of the Eidim Mitzvah Ve'Oseh as something that can bridge the gap between classical Judaism and modern culture. Almost 3 years ago, we invited Rabbanit Chana Henkin to speak for us. And she provided a different approach, again, trying to bring in this model to help us bridge this important gap. And she suggested not looking at something earlier in history, but looking at something that exists today. Looking at the status of women in much that they do within Orthodoxy, wherein we know that there are many areas wherein women are, just like Avraham Avinu, they're not commanded, and still they do. We know we have a whole industry, which Revitzin Henkin is a leading member of, wherein women are studying Gemara, studying all sorts of things that they're not obligated to do. And we know that there are many women who are involved in pursuing all sorts of religious opportunities, and they have done so traditionally, in areas that they're not obligated to do. So suggested Revitzin Henkin that the paradigm already exists, that women show us today, and more so, that there is an area that's not legislated. There are many things that we don't have to do, and yet we derive merit and are encouraged, she would encourage us, to in fact look into these areas, to develop ourselves, both in terms of creativity, in terms of individualism, and lastly, in terms of personal autonomy. However, here too, there exists a problem. The greatest issue that I see is that whether we want to follow this paradigm, I forgot to mention that her paradigm extends not only to areas that already exist, as I mentioned before, where men study Torah, women also can study Torah, but she suggests that perhaps the paradigm can be pushed further into areas where no ritual exists, and ritual can be created, also under this rubric of Eino Mitzuvah, in this case, Ve'osa. Example she gave, we have no Jewish ritual to celebrate a woman's birth experience. Yet she knows that some women have developed such a ritual, and she says that this might well be within the parameters, the traditional parameters, of Eino Mitzuvah Ve'osa, that she creates something in a gap where there's no actual command, but her creativity as well as her internal inspiration drives her to create a new ritual. Says Revitzin Henkin, this would be entirely within traditional parameters of what Judaism allows for and even encourages. But the problem, as I was about to say, is that I don't think Revitzin Henkin could deny that the central avenue of Jewish religious expression remains within the halakha. If we don't want to go to the extreme of Yeshaya Leibowitz, as Rabbi Cardoza mentioned earlier, that it is exclusively found in the halakha, still, primary expression of Judaism comes within halachic experience. And therefore, even if Revitzin Henkin wants to create an alternative track for us to indulge our autonomy and our creativity, we cannot get away from the fact that the central status that we live in and live by is that of mitzuveh ve'oseh, that we're commanded and that we don't have a choice, neither us nor our non-religious counterparts, in the fact that we have to do on some level what God expects us to do. As I said, what I'd like to do is to see whether we can come up with a bolder paradigm, to see whether we cannot find a way to understand halachic experience, mainstream halachic experience, as really something which, as a result of historical events, and I'm not referring to the Holocaust, but as a result of historic events, has changed to the point that halachic experience can be understood more as something as Rabbi Cardoza mentioned earlier this morning, as a voluntary experience. I'm going to start by analyzing what I think is the most central source about this issue, statement that appears, as far as I know, four times in the Babylonian Talmud, but the discussion of which really is centered in two specific places that I have given you on your source sheet today. The central statement we'll just look at very quickly, it's in the second line of source number one, source number one being Gemara and Kiddushin, page 31a, Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph, wherein the scholar Rabbi Chanina makes this important statement. He says, Amar Rav Chanina, Gadol Mitzuveh Ve'oseh, Mimi She'eno Mitzuveh Ve'oseh. He says that someone who's commanded is greater than someone who's not commanded. The context of this discussion, as well as the other major discussion we have on the bottom of the page, is comparing Jews to non-Jews. The Gemara in Abu Dazara, which if we have time we'll see later, makes the statement that even though the non-Jews are originally obligated in seven commandments, what's known as the Zion, the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, seven Noachide laws, that God historically decided to make these laws optional for non-Jews. They exist in principle, but they do not exist as law. That's the statement made. The Gemara says that by comparison, Jews in their 613 commandments are not only obligated in theory, but also obligated in fact. Jews are obligated and have to keep their commandments, as opposed to non-Jews who do not have to keep what God would like them to keep. And says Rabbi Chanina, and this is applied in other situations, we'll see the Gemara in Kiddushin trying to apply this to a blind person who may or may not be commanded to do commandments. And we know, as we said before, it can be applied to women. Tosfot makes this application, and presumably one could extend this to our forefathers before the Torah was given as well. But in any case, Rabbi Chanina makes the statement that it's better to be commanded to do something which is good, to do a divine precept, than not to be commanded. Now, there are many different opinions as to exactly what this means. And what one might have thought is really very straightforward, we'll see as a result of the different opinions, is not straightforward at all. And the reason I think this is important is because when you think about it, understanding the variable that makes someone commanded better than someone who's not commanded is going to help us understand this entire significance of being commanded. Who cares if something is good? Who cares whether I'm commanded or not commanded? What difference does it make? But in explaining the statement of Rabbi Chanina, where he says it does make a difference and it's better, we find the definition of the significance of being commanded. Now, in this discussion, there are two basic approaches. I won't belabor this because we don't have much time today. There are two basic approaches to this issue, what I call the quantitative approach and the qualitative approach. Quantitative approach means that the mitzvah, the person who's commanded, has two things going on for him. He's doing the right thing, as well as getting an extra credit. I'll explain this in a little more detail. As opposed to the qualitative approach, saying that the person who's commanded is doing something completely different than the person who's not commanded. Again, I'll explain this in greater detail. I have the sources for you, but for the benefit of time, I think we'll summarize rather than read through. I urge you to read the sources on your own after the talk. The Ramban is actually the first to come up with what seems to be the quantitative approach, but it's most clearly expressed and beautifully expressed by the Netziv, the famous Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva for much of its existence. In his seminal work, Hemek Davar, which Rabbi Cardoza, again, referred to from earlier this morning, in which the Netziv says that one should understand the idea of commandments, whether you're obligated to do them or not, as something like the field of medicine. He says that one should not understand commandments in the realm of a sovereign applying his will, meaning the following: that a doctor, when he prescribes medicine to a patient, is not telling his patient that if you don't do as I say, I will punish you. I will give you lashes. I will give you the death penalty. I will make you suffer. Rather, what the doctor is doing is simply informing, says the Netziv, uses the word modia, to explain and inform the patient of the benefits of medicine. If the patient chooses to listen to the doctor, he will get better. If the patient chooses not to listen to the doctor, he will suffer the consequences, but not as a result of the desire of the doctor to enforce his law, as much as simply, that's the nature of reality. Says the Netziv, again echoing on some level the words of Ramban, this is the way of divine precepts. Divine precepts are not arbitrary doctrines. Divine precepts, mitzvot, are simply God's way of telling us reality. If you follow what I tell you to do, it will be good for you. If you don't, it will be bad for you. The Netziv adds, however, that while that is true for Jew and non-Jew alike, that they should keep what God suggests that they do, that when it comes to the Jews, the doctor not only suggests, the doctor commands. The parallel that the Netziv uses is the same way the doctor can command his son to take the medicine. Ultimately, the bottom line is because the medicine will cure his son. But beyond that, the doctor can command and give additional reward. Give the child some sort of toy for keeping his will. So I call this quantitative in the sense that the person commanded, if you want, in the illustration, the son, has two things going on for him. He has the effect of the medicine itself, as well as the promise of additional reward from his father if he takes the medicine. The other patient, the standard patient, who's not the doctor's son, will only get one dimension in keeping the doctor's prescription. He will only get the effects of the medicine, but he will not be able to get the toy. That's the quantitative approach to this issue. The qualitative approach is mostly found in the Maharal of Prague, who, as in many places, takes a unique approach to the issue. The Maharal tells us there's a very big difference between someone commanded and someone not commanded. That someone commanded has God interested in that specific person doing an act. Whereas the person not commanded, God is not specifically interested in that person fulfilling the act. He gives an interesting illustration. The Maharal that I have on this sheet is from Chidush HaGadot on the first Gemara, the Gemara in Kiddushin, but he also speaks in the Chidush HaGadot, in the fourth volume, which is on the second Gemara at the bottom of the page, on Avodah Zarah, which is in Daf Gimel Amud Aleph. There the Maharal makes the following comparison. He says, if a king goes to one battalion, tells them, I want you to fight this battle for me. Clearly we see that the king is very interested and very involved in this battle being fought. Then the king goes at a different occasion to another battalion and says to the general, you decide whether to fight this battle or not. Says the Maharal, even if they decide to fight the king's battle, there's obviously a very big difference between the first battalion that's doing the king's intense desire and the second battalion who's only doing the king's desire. They're fighting the same way as the first group, but the desire of the king is much less involved, much less intense. And I would drive the parallel a little further and say that one could say the same thing about two different groups in the same war. The king goes to one group and says, I want you to fight. He goes to the second group and says to them, if you want to fight, please fight. Says the Maharal, you can't compare one with the other. Even though they go through the same motion, the act is actually very different. This might remind us of another approach, and this sounds mystical. I think on some level it is. It may remind us of what the Ramban, ironically, says about keeping mitzvot outside of Israel. So the same person can keep the exact same act, can put on the exact same tefillin in Israel, and one foot over the border, and be doing completely different acts. On a physical level, it's exactly the same. But says the Ramban, on a mystical level, there's no comparison. Says the Maharal, the same is true of someone commanded and someone not commanded. The physical act may be exactly the same, but in fact the quality, the nature of the act is entirely different. And the Maharal presumably gives us the examples of the battalions to show us that it's not entirely a mystical conception. But rather the issue for the Maharal, I believe, and I think he says this later, or implies it, is that the issue, and this reminds us of Leibovitz, is not the benefit of man, per se. But rather the bottom line is the benefit, kaviyachol, of God. That really the issue is not doing something that's good for us, but doing something that God wants us to do. So we have two very different approaches. Whether we take the quantitative approach of the Netziv, that tells us ultimately the person commanded and the person not commanded are involved in the same experience, the same basic experience. The only thing is whether there's an added prize put into the pot because of the command. But ultimately the experience, the fighting of the Maharal or the prescription of the Netziv is ultimately really the same. And then there's the qualitative approach of the Maharal, which tells us that in fact the experience is not at all the same. It may look the same from the outside. The soldier is still fighting the battle using the same weapons. But in terms of the king's desire, it's completely different. Now, it's important to understand this in and of itself. But I think one of the main issues, main reasons I wanted you to hear about this is because one of the major objections that people will probably have to the idea of saying that we're not really commanded anymore. One might say, if you're not really commanded, then who's going to do mitzvot? If we're not really commanded, if God doesn't expect us, whatever that means, to keep the mitzvot, then perhaps religious Jews will not keep mitzvot if it's a choice. Who knows? So I think this really depends on whether we're going to take the approach of the Maharal or the Netziv. Certainly according to the Maharal, where the issue is pleasing the commander, we see there's a big difference whether we're commanded or not. If we're not commanded, God is not really that concerned whether we do the commandments or not. And certainly that will undermine our motivation. On the other hand, if we take the Netziv's approach, which I think is going to be a more dominant approach, in that it's a less mystical approach, we see that really, ultimately, the issue is the worth of the mitzvot themselves. That's ultimately why we keep mitzvot. The toy that the doctor is going to give to his son is really a very trite motivation. It's a motivation that's ultimately unnecessary if the child, or any patient for that matter, realizes what's at stake. And I think there's additional support to this approach from the Gemara itself. The understanding that we, who follow the Jewish tradition, should realize that the stakes in keeping the mitzvot, whether we're obligated or not, are tremendous, are vital, are issues of life and death. Going back to the Netziv's parable of the doctor, if one would expect the patient to listen to a doctor for any serious disease, certainly if the doctor were to inform any of us that our life is at stake, and all we have to do is follow a certain prescription, I can't imagine anyone in the room not following the prescription. And it's interesting that the Gemara may see mitzvot very much in those terms. The Gemara that I have at the very bottom, source number 4, this is talking about non-Jews. And we have Rabbi Meir saying the following, Rabbi Meir Omer, Menayin she'afilo oved kochavim ve'osek betorah shehu kekohen gadol. How do we know that a non-Jew who studies Torah is like, has the same status as a Kohen Gadol? So he quotes the Pasuk from Vayikra. Says Talmud Lomar, we learn from the verse, Asher yaseh otam adam v'chai behem. It says that a person should do the precepts, should do mitzvot, and live through them. Says Rabbi Meir, Kohanim levim Yisrael lo nemar el ha'adam. It doesn't say just Jews, just Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim. It says a person. A person who does mitzvot, who does precepts, he will live. And by extrapolation, I imagine, a person who does not do precepts, not only Jews, but even those who are not commanded, specifically non-Jews, as that's what we're talking about in this Gemara, if they do the precepts, if they do mitzvot, even if they're not commanded to do them, they will live. If they don't do them, presumably they will die. As a result, the Gemara, I think, gives support to the approach of the Netziv, that ultimately, the reason a person keeps mitzvot is not so much because we're commanded, because the commander expects it of us, but because it's our lifeblood, Jew and non-Jew alike. Now, I want to ask a question that's a little removed from the Jewish tradition, but I think it's important to ask it in order to understand the Jewish tradition better. And that is to say, whether we can assume that we're commanded all together in our time, in modern times. By that I mean, we all understand that God commanded us at Sinai, and that we have been placed in this category of being commanded, that we're expected to do mitzvot. But is that what defines commandedness? Is that really what defines our status, as opposed to those who are not commanded? In order to do this, I took a little field trip into the field of philosophy of law. I don't pretend to be an expert, and I understand there are a few people here who have background in law, so I'm a little bit afraid to even dabble in this area. But the reason I go into this area is to really ratify something that I think is intuitive, as I think philosophy should be when it is correct. In this field, there's great discussion about what law is. What makes law valid? What makes it normative? Why should we listen to law? Are we obligated to listen to all law? And there are basically two schools of thought. The prevalent school of thought, which is known as legal positivism, basically states that law is not what ought to be. It's not a question of doing what ought to be, but doing what is obeyed. In other words, according to the positivists, a doctrine cannot be said to be a law. In other words, we can't really be understood as people that are commanded unless that law is generally observed. Say that again. That law cannot really be expected to be understood as law unless it's generally observed. Now, the traditional philosophers, Bentham and John Austin, who were the pioneers of this approach, focused more on coercion and authority. If something is enforced, then it's law. If something is not enforced, then it really can't be said to be law. More recent scholars, Hart, and actually the leading scholar in the field right now is an Israeli who is in the law faculty at Cambridge, someone by the name of Yosef, or Joseph as he's known, Raz, who has developed this field further, makes it more dependent on social norms as opposed to authority. In other words, not really whether it's enforced, but whether the law is observed or obeyed. But according to this school of thought, and again, this is the dominant school of thought in legal philosophy, something can't be called law if it's not observed. And therefore, we obviously have great questions about the Jewish tradition. Again, not so much because of Bentham and Raz, but because it's something that makes sense. I'll give you a everyday example, especially those of you from New York, where this is most commonly an occurrence. We all know that in the books, it's illegal to cross the street at a red light. And I don't think that within the books, I haven't checked them, but probably be willing to wager money on it, I don't think in the books there's going to be exceptions as to whether cars are coming or not. Again, according to the theories of Raz, that would defeat the purpose. If the whole point of a red light is for me to decide when to cross and when not to cross, then the red light is of no purpose. The red light is supposed to impose upon me something that I would not otherwise do. But, nonetheless, we all know that in New York and many other places, people, in fact, do cross at red lights when they believe it to be safe. Yet, if we were to ask these people, in spite of the fact that this is a law and everyone knows it's a law, do you feel compelled by the state to wait out the light until it turns green? I imagine many of them would hesitate and not be so clear that they in fact required by the law to wait for the green light, even though they are aware that the law is in fact that they do need to wait for the light. The reason, again, going back to this school of thought, is that the law in those places is not observed and it's not enforced, according to the two respective approaches to legal positivism. Now, if we were to apply this to religious law, to Torah law, we could state that neither enforcement nor observance are something that are universally the case. And if anything, they're the exception rather than the rule. We know that most Jews do not live in accordance with halakha as traditionally defined. And in fact, one could, and this is perhaps going to be an issue, a further discussion between Rabbi Cardoza and myself, one could, on this point, divide the Jewish people into two groups, and in fact, reinforce Rabbi Cardoza's position that there are those that follow the halakha, and therefore, for whom they are validating and accepting the law, and therefore, are in fact finding themselves in a situation of mitzuveh v'oseh. And the other community, if we can define it as an independent community, I think this is going to be the issue, can be viewed as eino mitzuve from this point of view, in the sense that they do not keep the law. However, in the interest of Jewish unity, and I think on some level it's more true to contemporary reality, the Jewish community still exists, for better or worse, and hopefully for better, as one community. And from that vantage point, if we're to look at the whole community as one community, Jewish law is, as I said before, more flaunted than observed. And from that point of view, we cannot say that the law is legally binding. Again, from that point of view, we're not trying to eliminate the status from a technical point of view. God has commanded and still expects us to do the mitzvot. But on a very real level, that doesn't necessarily translate into being commanded. The second point of view, in terms of punishment, the second issue rather, in terms of punishment, coercion, are we coerced to do the mitzvot? I think on a very real level, we are not, even though in religion we speak about enforcement. There's really two levels of enforcement, both eternal enforcement, we talk about olam ha'emet, divine reward and punishment in the afterlife, is certainly one dimension that has not changed. We don't view that to be changed for any reason whatsoever. However, in this world, there is almost no coercion to follow religious law, which has not always been the case. In traditional Jewish society, in ancient times, we had a melech, and even after that, we had a beit din, and they would enforce Jewish law to coerce it. It's interesting that H.L.A. Hart, who was Raz's teacher, also pointed out that there needs to be coercion for something to really be considered law. And I would question whether coercion exists, both on a human level and even on a divine level. As Rabbi Cardoza mentioned before, there's an issue today, and has been for many, many centuries, of hester panim, for lack of intervention on God's behalf in human affairs. And as a result, from this perspective, without taking our obligation off the books, on a very real level, on what we could call a de facto level, we cannot really be considered as mitzuveh ve'oseh. Unless you think this is only, so to speak, a goyish concept and has no place in understanding our status, I would remind you of something that we say, most of us say, three times a day at the very end of our prayers. We quote a verse in Zechariah. If you want to look it up in its original source, it's Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Tet, where we say, V'haya l'Hashem, Hashem l'melech ha'kol ha'aretz, b'yom ahu yashem echad u'shmo echad. That in the future, God will be king. On some level, there's no greater apikorsut than the statement to say that in the future, God will be king. Right, and the Gemara actually addresses the second part of the statement, that he will be one. Similar apikorsut, perhaps even more extreme, which is why the Gemara addresses it. But to say that God only will be king and is not currently king can only be understood according to the approach that we've just presented. That on some level, what is more critical is not the theory of what ought to be, as is the other school in legal philosophy, what one calls natural law, but rather what is in fact law, what we call de facto law. And while God is, in theory, in truth, God and King throughout history, he will only be de facto, in practice, King when he is recognized by all who live on the earth. So therefore, this distinction that I'm making is not an artificial one that only is a creation of legal philosophers of the last 200 years, but I think it's something that is understood in Jewish tradition as well. We're running out of time, and I want to make one more observation, that there are more observations to be made about whether our status has not, in fact, changed. And that is another little piece on the side, again, you'll read it at your own leisure, wherein the Tosafot, I think, emphasize this position. Again, addressing this issue of what makes the commanded person greater than the one who's not commanded is a sense of pressure that one has to do it. One feels forced into it. That's what makes it harder, and as a result, that's what makes us get more reward. Right? To use a more colloquial expression, the idea is essentially one of no pain, no gain. According to Tosfot, we feel pain because we're forced to do it. We feel coercion. According to what we just said, we could readily ask whether in fact we feel so much coercion. And if we don't, at least according to Tosafot, and this is the objection of the Maharal against Tosafot, then in fact, there is really no difference between being commanded and not being commanded unless coercion exists. And I would argue, and I'm not sure that this is Tosfot's point, but I would argue that the coercion that's most relevant is coercion that's tangible and something that's a part of our day-to-day experience. When Beit Din is there to enforce the law, when the Melech is there to enforce the law, even when God is there, or there's the threat of divine intervention, that can be considered a situation where being commanded is significant. Otherwise, I would suggest, at least according to this major approach in the Rishonim, that being commanded is really of really no significance. Again, that's not to say that we're not commanded, but it's to say that that's not the point. Again, according to the Netziv's approach that we mentioned earlier, we need not do what God asks us to do because He asks us to do it, but rather the wise person does it because it's the correct thing to do. And if we are to take this approach, not so much taking the status off the books as much as to say that it's really not relevant. And really, the issue is not so much in whether we're mitzuver, eino mitzuver, because in our times, we're just as well as being eino mitzuver, even if technically we might be commanded. Ultimately, it makes no difference in our time. And therefore, we had better take a good look at the second part of the statement, which is not the issue of whether we're commanded or not, but whether we do it or not. And I think it's important that we realize that with the weakening of the first part of the statement, with the weakening of the issue of commandedness, the idea that we perhaps may not really be commanded in a significant way, that we had better focus much more on the oseh, on the need to understand the importance of doing, the importance of what mitzvot are about, and understanding that in fact it is a prescription for life. Going back to the example of the red and green lights, I think that would be not easy to convince someone who's about to cross a red light that the law is in the books, and you're commanded to do it, therefore stop. I don't think that would carry much weight in contemporary society. What would carry much more weight, and I think this is how we need to approach Torah and Judaism today, is to explain why even when there are not cars coming, it is a wise thing, it is a proper thing, and it is a correct thing not to cross at the light. I suggest we take that approach to Judaism not only for the uninitiated, but to ourselves as well, with the realization that we don't need the toy, and the toy may not be offered to any great extent anymore anyways. That we need to follow the mitzvot with the understanding that in our times on very much of a great level, it is our choice. Even if God expects us to do it, from the point of view of what we see around us, it is our choice. And therefore we need to understand what will motivate others as well as ourselves to make that choice. Again, I'll summarize what I've said. And as a caveat, I want to make sure that no one's misunderstood. I don't want anyone to come out of here saying that I've echoed Rabbi Yitzhak Greenberg's words before, that we are not commanded at all. I don't think that we have a right to impose a new theology. But I do believe that times have changed, that historical events have created things that are beyond our control, by which even if we are commanded on a technical level, that the significance of that is almost nil. And therefore, we have an obligation to re-examine what it means to observe mitzvot, what it means to follow the commandments. I started with two paradigms that suggested invoking the Eino Mitzuveh Ve'oseh as a way to bridge the gap between modernity, between Western civilization and classical Jewish thought. What I pointed out in that both of these suggestions were limited in that this expression would be marginalized. What I'm suggesting, and I'm only suggesting with a variety of possible ways, and there are more that I've not presented, and perhaps another time we'll present them, that through this variety of approaches within classical Jewish sources, we can see that the paradigm of Eino Mitzuveh Ve'oseh is something that may not only apply to women, may not apply only historically, but apply to all of us today. My intention was not to prove anything conclusively, but rather to open a door, to show you that we can no longer be sure that we can completely be described as people commanded to do the mitzvot. Again, not to say that we're not on a technical level, but to say that perhaps this is not really accurate on a factual de facto level, as we've said. Such a question, I hope, will make us rethink why we do mitzvot. It's my hope that such reevaluation will have a positive impact on our ultimate adherence to the mitzvot, meaning not only to the will of God, but also to the wisdom of God. Thank you.